Dean, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have with us students who are here for the oral argument. We have class, the 11th High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. We have Notre Dame Academy. Would those students stand? What community is that in?
Green Bay.
Green Bay. Thank you. You may be seated. Thank you for coming. It's a long drive. And we have Sun Prairie Sacred Heart School, 8th grade. Would those students please stand? And who's their teacher? Good seeing you. And I believe that Justice Crooks's granddaughter is in the class. Would she raise her hand?
You may not want to do that.
Oh, I'm sure you're going to be very proud of your grandfather today, just as you are every day.
Chief, does this mean I have to behave?
Expecting too much. Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with us because the court and the State Bar of Wisconsin run a program called Court with Class. We invite students to come. And the students are, if they accept the invitation, are given copies of the briefs, which were substantial in this case, and may have extra activities relating to the case. Then, at noon, after this case is heard, the students will meet with a justice of the court, and a discussion will be held on the substantive, issues of the case, but only on the procedures that the court uses in taking and deciding cases. And everyone is welcome to attend that session. It's not limited to the students. So now let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Seated to my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, person you've already heard about, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Logan-Sack. With those introductions made, I will now call the second case today, 1325 North Van Buren, LLC versus T3 Group Limited. Before counsel begin, if anyone would like a summary of the facts and legal issue in this case, the marshal has such a summary. Just raise your hand and she will give you one. It's easier to understand the case if you read the summary. Okay, good. But, all right. We are going to hear first. Oh, we've got a lineup, so let me make sure we all agree. 10 minutes, David Hannes of T3 Group, representing T3 Group. 10 minutes, Tom Kubich. Say that to me again. Tom Kubich, representing Westport Insurance. 30 minutes, Patrick O'Connor from Minneapolis, to be introduced by Wisconsin attorney Kimberly Hurtado. 30 minutes, 5 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Hannes, 5 minutes rebuttal, Tomkovich. Thank you. All right, do we agree on that? All right, we will begin with Mr. Hannes.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is David Hannes, and I represent the defendant, respondent, petitioner, T3 Group Limited. My comments this morning will be confined to the issue of whether 1325's tort claims are barred under the economic loss doctrine. I take no position with respect to the issues relating to insurance coverage. That being said, I think this is a case, rather, it's difficult for me to imagine a commercial dispute that would present a more compelling case for the application of the economic loss doctrine than this one. The case at bar is an action between two sophisticated commercial parties who entered into a comprehensive 102-page contract to construct a 42-unit condominium building for a price of $6 million. A contract that exhaustively addresses the rights and obligations of the parties and which includes a comprehensive remedial scheme with a host of bargain-for remedies and risk allocation provisions that are carefully tailored to the subject matter of the transaction and which make the default one-size-fits-all remedial provisions of the UCC truly pale by comparison. Among other things, the risk allocation and remedial provisions in the contract include a broad form express warranty, insurance and bonding requirements, a broad form indemnification agreement, per diem liquidated damages, authority for the owner's architect to reject non-conforming work, a provision allowing the owner to stop work and carry out work if the contractor fails to perform in accordance with the contract documents, provisions relating to withholding from compensation in the event of termination or suspension of T3, a provision for exclusion from T3's reimbursable cost of the work for the cost of correcting defective and non-conforming work or damage to property caused by the acts or omissions of T3 or its subcontractors, and the list goes on. It is, reading this contract from cover to cover, one would be hard-pressed to conceive of something that these parties may have left out or how they could have been any more careful in spelling out their intentions with respect to risk allocation and remedies in the event of the breach. With respect to the damages at issue in this case, it is undisputed that the only damages claimed by 1325 are for purely economic losses flowing from the alleged breach of the agreement, including, to quote their own itemization of damages.
So, counsel, what was the primary product of this 102-page contract? Was it services or was it a product?
The purpose of the contract was to construct a 42-unit luxury condominium building.
Let me just ask you. So you would, obviously, you think that this falls in the Linden case category?
Absolutely, we do, Your Honor. And we have included.
Which I don't think was, let's see, when this was started, Linden wasn't out, was it then?
That is correct. Linden came down after the Court of Appeals decided our case.
But you asked them for a reconsideration, didn't you?
We did not ask for reconsideration. The time to do so, I believe, had run at that time.
Did someone else ask them? My understanding of the record is the motion for reconsideration was asked for after Linden was released by our court, and the Court of Appeals denied the motion for reconsideration. I may be wrong, but that's my understanding of it.
And mine.
That may be correct, Your Honor. I do not recall that procedural detail.
Mr. Hannes, I don't mean to nitpick words, but I'm looking at your brief, and am I correct? You just argued that the purpose of the contract was to construct a 42-unit building. But in your brief, didn't you stress that the purpose was to convert a warehouse into a 42-unit building? And the fact that you're dealing with a renovation as opposed to a new construction, does that make a difference?
It's an excellent point, Justice Butler, but in the final analysis, I do not believe that it makes a difference in this case. The building was essentially gutted and stripped to its bare structural elements and converted from one use to another, from a bare-bones warehouse facility, as it's described as a warehouse facility in the contract, to a 42-unit luxury condominium complex complete with a new penthouse and new parking garages. So I appreciate the distinction, but I do not believe that it makes a difference in this case.
Well, the reason I ask the question is the number of the things that you described that had to be done sound a lot like services to be performed. that you listed right in the contract, all the things that had to be done sounded like service. And as I understood the Linden distinction, what was being bargained for was a completed product at the end. They're buying a home, and it's how you get to the home. Whereas here, admittedly, you may have a new construction on a parking ramp, but here you're converting an already existing item.
I think we need look no further than Exhibit B to the contract, which appears at page 135 of our appendix, to get a sense as to what was being furnished by T3. Concrete, masonry, metals, woods and plastics, thermal protection, doors and windows, finishes, specifications, equipment, furnishings, special construction, conveying systems, mechanical systems, all totaling up to about $5.7 million. The fee for construction management services was a mere $176,000, and that is roughly 2.7% of the total contract price. So it seems clear that the bulk of this contract was for lack of a better term, the guts of the building, the components of the building, as opposed to construction.
And the renovation of the building. I mean, there's still the work that has to be done.
There's work that has to be done in any construction project, just as in the Linden case. And, in fact, the service provider, the contractor, subcontractor at issue in Linden was a service provider. Yet the court applied the economic loss doctrine nonetheless.
I listened to what Justice Butler is saying. Would it be incorrect to say that the predominant product here, or the predominant intent of this was construction rather than, if we're going to argue services versus whether it's renovation of an apartment or a condo or anything, what your argument seems to be is that you're providing products.
I think, Justice Wilcox, in our brief, we run through a comprehensive analysis of the predominant purpose test, and I believe that every single factor, objective and subjective, weighs in our favor in coming to the conclusion that the predominant purpose of this contract was to construct a building.
Mr. Hannes, quite obviously, we can't just apply a percentage in looking at predominant purpose. What are the significant factors that you think we should be applying here?
The significant factors, I agree with the Linden Court's factors relating to application of the predominant purpose test. First off, was it a fixed price contract that was subject to change for changes in scope, or was the contract one that was the price for which was based upon the amount of time spent? Clearly, in this instance, this was a fixed price contract. The price of the contract was subject to change only for changes in the scope of the work. No portion was dependent upon the amount of time spent. There was simply a nominal fixed fee for construction management related services. With respect to service words versus product words, I think the Linden ultimately comes down on the side of quantitative. The quantitative number of service words versus the quantitative number of product words doesn't really make a difference. We look at the contract as a whole, and if it's clear to us that the predominant purpose is for construction, to construct a building, then it's a contract essentially for a product, not for services.
Was your client a manager here, or do you think it's a more appropriate way to look at this to say that your client was like a general contractor?
I believe that is an appropriate characterization, though not quite. This is an AIA 121 CMC agreement between owner and construction manager, where the construction manager is also the constructor. The construction manager has full responsibility to deliver all of the components in a fully completed building to the owner, regardless of whether, and this contract, by the way, gives the CM the option to self-perform work or retain subcontractors, just like a general contractor would. The the distinction I see between this form and the other AIA form, which is the CMA agreement, is that under the CMA agreement, the CM, the construction manager, is serving in merely an advisory capacity. In fact, that's what the small A designation stands for. The small C designation in the AIA 121 CMC stands for constructor, to signify that the CM is actually building the building. So I think that's a significant and I believe that it would be a gross mischaracterization of this contract to label it a pure services contract, something in the nature of a CMA. It isn't. It simply is not.
Is
I believe my time is up.
Yes, but in effect, is could your client have constructed, hired its own people and constructed this?
Absolutely. The contract provides that work may be self-performed by the CM, though I believe, and counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that the CM would have to solicit bids, competitive bids, before self-performing work, and those bids would have to be submitted to the owner.
You think it's, your client is stands in the shoes of a general contractor?
Under the AIA 121 CMC agreement, it is most closely analogous to the general contractor situation as opposed to the CMA agreement, where this construction manager is serving in merely an advisory capacity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Does T3 have any cause of action against its subcontractors?
Does it have a cause of action against its subcontractors? It's difficult to answer that question.
Why?
It's not clear to me. It depends upon whether we have an action in contract or an action in tort.
What difference does it make?
Thank you.
I'm sorry. What difference does it make? Didn't the sub contract with your client?
Well, at the end of the day, the contractors were not made parties to this case. They are not defendants.
But suppose you're found liable. Can't you sue them on the breach of contract or negligent performance?
Possibly on a claim for contribution, which doesn't arise until we've discharged more than our fair share.
Okay. Well, suppose you had brought them into this lawsuit. I'm trying to get rid of a procedural problem in answer to Justice Prosser's question. They had been brought into this lawsuit. Can you sue them for breach of contract? Did the contracts run to you, or did they run to 1325?
Some of them would have run to T3. Some were taken over by 1325. It's a mixed bag.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chief, if I may just describe it.
Does your reticence your hesitancy in response to Justice Prosser's question, you said it depends on whether it's an action, contract, or tort. Does that then implicate the coverage question upon which you are not appearing?
Honestly, I can't answer that question. And not because I don't want to, but because, frankly, I have not looked at the coverage issues, and I deliberately isolated myself from those issues.
None of these coverage issues cover you. I mean, the policies don't cover you, do they? They cover 1325.
The Westport policy was issued to T3.
Okay.
My understanding.
All right. So you haven't looked at that, though, for purposes of this.
My representation of T3 in this case is limited to defense of the merits of the claims asserted against T3. I do not take any position with respect to matters relating to insurance coverage.
Got it. The one that would benefit from the professional liability who would get the money is 1325.
Yes.
1320, if I would get the money, you might have bought the policy. The beneficiary will be...
1325
got it.
Has an interest in establishing coverage. That's true.
Right. Okay. Thank you, counsel. Representing Westport.
Good morning. May it please the court and my counsel. I'm Vince Tomkiewicz. I represent Westport Insurance Corporation.
Excuse me, counsel. Could you lift up the microphone? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
The whole platform.
Yeah, you can even lift the whole thing up if it's
not.
Okay,
I
got it. Is it? Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's a lot better. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm Vince Tomkiewicz on behalf of Westport Insurance Corporation. I'm from the firm of Bollinger, Ruber & Garvey in Chicago, but I trust this court won't hold that against me.
Are
you
licensed in
this state? I am,
Your Honor. Okay. And we consider you a Wisconsin lawyer.
When I'm here, I say I'm from Wisconsin. When I'm in Illinois, I say I'm from Illinois.
Okay.
I'm going to try to address to this court two issues, the economic loss doctrine, as well as the way that doctrine dovetails with some of the insurance coverage issues particular to Westport Insurance Corporation. I do want to note initially, though, on the procedural issue that the court raised, looking through my notes, the decision of the Court of Appeals was in May 2005. I believe that we filed petitions and cross petitions to appeal, and then Linden was issued in July 2005. So it's my recollection that the Linden decision by this court postdated the requests by Westport and T3 for leave to appeal to this court. Subsequently, I believe this court invited letter briefs from all of us on the application of Linden. Those were submitted, and then I believe the briefs were also submitted soon after that. So procedurally, Linden postdated the Court of Appeals decision, obviously, but it predated our movement for leave to appeal to this court. With that said, I want to focus on some of the same things that counsel for T3 has focused on, and the economic loss doctrine, but from a slightly different angle. My focus is more on the nature of the claims, and I believe the court touched on this briefly with T3's counsel. The nature of the claims here are defeated economic expectation. What happened was that the contract was for a new building, essentially, using an old structure that involved entirely reworking of that old structure. I mean, it went from a warehouse to a 42-unit condominium building. The nature of the claims arising out of the failed contract are remedies that I think are based in a contract and should be addressed by contract. The work proceeded for some period of time before T3 was terminated from the job, and the project was never completed on T3's watch. That's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that that happened, but that essentially amounted to a failure in performance. In the general contract tort sort of distinction that we're going to be focusing on today, a failure in performance is a contract remedy that should be addressed by contracts, as opposed to tort-based remedies that are better left for negligence and tort-based claims.
Also, is it significant that there are claims of property damage here? As you know, that's a factor in looking at whether or not the economic loss doctrine applies. And it's my understanding that there are allegations that there was damage to the property itself. How is that significant or not significant to your position?
Well, I think in the first instance, Judge, those claims for what may be considered other property damage are de minimis. The brunt of the claim, looking at T3's damages model, is for the failure to perform the contract. There may have been damage to parts of the structure when the construction was ongoing, but we would submit, and I believe T3 would submit, that those were part of the work itself. For instance, walls that were going to be worked on were damaged and then worked on again by T3 and other subcontractors. So looking at the integrated unit, the building as a whole, Justice Crooks, I don't believe that there was damage to what we would generally consider other property. For other property purposes, under Wisconsin law, and I believe under the application of the economic loss doctrine, it would envision damage to structures other than the work itself. For instance, a car that's parked next to the building on top of which mortar or bricks fall, or similar to a bodily injury claim, a person who's injured as a result of the construction work is kind of out of the basket of the economic loss doctrine damages. And again, the nature of the claims here are, for the most measure, there's defective work that had to be repaired. There was work that wasn't completed that needed to be completed. We had to pay another contractor to come in and finish this work.
Tell us, what's the difference in either amount or theory between contract damages here and tort damages? If it's a breach of a contract and failing to perform and you have to do additional work, you'd get paid for that. What's the difference with tort? I mean, what punitive damages, other than punitive damages, what's the difference?
Well, I think Justice, if a tort-based claim were allowed, the scope of tort-based remedies would be greatly increased. It could be anything that reasonably flowed from the breach of contract. I suppose, and I'm kind of winging it here, I suppose that would include things like delayed expenses that are unrelated to the construction itself, or maybe the loss of the use of that money while the construction was ongoing. But I think, I'm sorry.
Well, every time I look this up, I find that there's really very little difference, and that reasonable, foreseeable damages are contract damages, too. Now, maybe there's a drop or some sharp line or not so sharp line as to reasonable foreseeability, if you want to use that term, between tort and contract. But other than punitive damages, whenever I look this up, whenever I think about it, I get stuck, except for punitive damages, that there's not that much.
I guess in the context of construction, though, Your Honor, and especially when there's no damage to any other property or no damage to any person or body, the damages are contract damages. That is the...
I'm not fighting about that. I'm just trying to figure out why you're fussing about contract versus tort. If I think, maybe I'm wrong, that's why I'm pressing you, that the damages are going to be roughly the same except for punitive. Now, I may be wrong. Maybe you lost profits. Maybe that's not allowed under contract and is under tort. That's what I'm pushing you about.
I'm not suggesting that you're wrong on that issue, Judge, though, but with respect to the way the parties negotiated and contracted, it accounted...
Okay, I accept that. I accept that. This is a contract case. I'm not debating that. I accept that. Except that you can't have contract damages. I'm wondering what the fight is about. Now, there may be a fight as the insurance company because your coverage might be different for tort and contract. I'm willing to accept that. So let's talk about that, if you think I'm right.
I do believe you're right, Judge. I believe the motion...
It's a good start, counsel.
Sorry?
It's always a good start. Go ahead. Tell us whether you'd be liable if it's contract or if you'd be liable if it's tort. Well, or not liable, whichever way it is.
In the first instance, Judge, we believe, and of course I may be repeating myself, the nature of the claims are contract-based claims. That said, though, Judge, the Westport coverage and most general liability coverage and professional liability coverage dovetails with this issue of what are the nature of the claims. What
it dovetails, but is it necessarily conclusive?
Well, it may not be, Your Honor, but to the extent that a party can bring a claim against an insured, policies in general don't cover for the fortuitous, they cover for fortuitous events and unexpected events. A breach of a contract, just in general purposes, isn't a fortuitous event. It's something expected, and in this case, it was anticipated. The parties negotiated for just that possibility.
This is what I'm focusing on in my question. When I say it dovetails, but it's not necessarily conclusive. It's not that. The economic loss doctrine, as I see it, essentially determines how a loss can be recovered. Can you pursue it in contract? Can you pursue it in tort? You know, and we've got a lot of jurisprudence that discusses this. Whether or not something is covered, I'll tell you what I do when I have a coverage question. The very first thing that I do, or if I don't, I should do, is pick up that policy and read what the policy says. Because the policy And it always says something like, you know, we will pay for everything the insured is obligated to pay. That's kind of standard. And you've got to read this thing. You've got to read it. Because what the words are in here controls coverage, not whether some court says the economic loss doctrine applies or doesn't apply. Do you agree with that or
entirely
disagree with that?
Okay. Entirely. In the West,
so what language are we talking about?
The Westport policy, and it, again, it's a professional liability policy, covers losses which the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as a result of a claim by reason of a wrongful act. And a wrongful act is an actual or alleged negligent act, error, or omission. So, again, it's
negligent act, error, or omission. Okay. You're saying it's not negligent because you can't do a tort. Right?
That's correct. There are two.
Okay.
Chief, if I might. Mr. Tomkiewicz, I see a distinction between this case and Linden, and I want to stress where I see the distinction. I'd like you to respond to it. In the Linden case, you had some homeowners, and we focused on the contract between the homeowners and the contractor. You had homeowners that wanted to purchase a home. Now, they had to build it, but the contract was for the purchase of a product, a home. All right. Here you have 1325 that enters into a contract for a renovation of a building that's going to be resold to new buyers. Now, the fact that they both involve construction doesn't really answer the question. You have a different contract for a different purpose. You don't have a homeowner buying a home, buying a product. You have a company out there trying to do something to an already existing building. And a lot of what was being done is service-oriented. I mean, the building of the building, the wiring of the electricity, all that, that's all service stuff. So given the fact that we're not focusing on that original contract where a party is buying a product, but you have a party who's trying to do something, who's trying to have services done to a building to renovate it for purposes of resale, does the economic loss doctrine really apply here? Is Linden really controlling?
I think it does, Judge, and I think for a few reasons. And, in fact, it may be more applicable here than in Linden. In Linden, I believe the contract was not, I'm going to buy a widget or a house. I think the contract was, we are contracting with contractor to build this house. I think it's really a distinction without a large difference, Judge. In both cases, contractors were hired to build an end product, to build something that people could move into. And in this instance, more so than in Linden, the parties negotiated this contract to the bones. I mean, they negotiated it back and forth on every sort of issue of rights and remedies, what would be done in the event of delay, what could be done if work was not performed properly, which I think it should be emphasized, Judge, because in terms of economic loss doctrine application, the allocation of risks between the parties is one of the key factors this Court's to consider, and I think it should be considered. Linden, again, it kind of involved a step removed. The Lindens had settled with the general contractor. The general contractor was out of the case. Yet this Court said that the Lindens' claims against the subcontractors were equally bound by the economic loss doctrine because the basic core of the dispute and the core of the relationship was contractual.
But we focused on the original contract, not on the subcontracts.
Yeah. Well, I think the Court – I don't mean to put words in the Court's mouth, but I believe the Court focused on the original contract to determine that the dispute should be resolved based upon the general contract as a starting point. I agree there were subcontractors involved, but the original core of the relationship was the contractual one.
Did T3 buy negligence coverage from a different company?
No, Judge, Justice, I don't think they did. What T3 had, it had a lot of insurance, but it had general liability insurance with Indiana Insurance, and it had what's called an errors and omission policy with my client, with Westport Insurance. The general liability insurance with Indiana is occurrence-based coverage. That is, that's coverage for anything that arises out of an accident on a project. Our coverage, Westport's coverage, is much more specific. It's coverage related to the negligent acts, errors, and omissions on a project. So in most respects, there's coverage under a GL policy for more than there is under an Arizona emissions policy, to the extent that ours is tethered to negligent conduct. Ours is tethered to that in two ways. There's a legal obligation to pay, which courts have held legal obligation is a tort-based liability, and the wrongful act out of which the claim arises must be an actual or alleged negligent act, error, and omission. The negligent requirement in the body of the insuring agreement itself makes the Westport policy, we believe, tethered to negligence claims. In American Girl, the court opined on whether an occurrence-based policy could cover a breach of contract claim, and one of Justice Sykes' points was that the word negligence doesn't appear in occurrence-based coverage. There's no connection or nexus between occurrence-based coverage and actual negligent conduct. There can be coverage for an accident without negligence. In our policy, there is a requirement of negligence.
Counselor, in your policy, there are several exclusions, one of which, item number K, under subsection 5, I believe it is, says that there's no coverage for express warranties or guarantees. Does that have any bearing on your opinion on whether there's coverage under this policy?
Well, yes, it can, Justice. I believe that type of exclusion would come into effect in the event, first, that a court, or this court or a court, determines that the insuring agreement is triggered. That
the is negligence, correct?
Right.
So it's a second step.
Correct. For instance, if there could be coverage for both a negligence-based claim arising out of the building, but not for a warranty-based claim. For instance, if a wall fell down and damaged a third party or property, there may be coverage for claims arising out of negligence in constructing that wall, whereas there may not be coverage to repair or replace or warrant the wall itself.
Thank you. Counsel, where in the policy does it speak about coverage for negligent-based claims? Does it use that language, or does it use the language negligent act, error, or omission? There's a difference, of course.
Well,
and that goes to my dovetailing as and conclusive, that distinction. So where, show me in the policy where you only provide coverage for negligently based claims. I need that information.
You're focusing on the right parts, Judge. And the insuring agreement itself, and combined with the definitions, provides, again, for coverage for loss, which the insured becomes legally obligated to pay. So there, right there, is a negligence-based concept.
But can't you become legally obligated to pay for a breach of contract? I mean, isn't that what... it seems to me, I might be wrong, but it seems to me that if you sue in contract, if I sue in contract against, let me pick someone in the courtroom.
Right here.
No. You're naughty. Someone in the back row. I sue them in contract, and lo and behold, I win in contract. Aren't they legally obligated to pay?
Historically, Judge, and I don't mean to lecture the court on contracts 101, but historically,
don't answer that. This has to be at least 203, not 101.
I don't want to date anybody. Historically, no, Judge. There would be an obligation by that sued party to pay for the contract loss, but for insurance coverage purposes, there has been a distinction historically between a legal obligation to pay and a contractual-based obligation to pay, for the simple reason that insurance coverage is generally afforded for fortuitous circumstances unrelated to parties bargaining for expectations.
You see, I think that that's why I talk about, you look at the policy. Of course, this is not the policy. I'm holding it up for demonstrative purposes. But let's say I have a contract. No doubt about it. It's a contract, and it's a contract under any kind of economic loss doctrine sort of approach. It's a contract. And I contract with someone and say, because I have something that needs refrigeration, I need a ton of ice by Tuesday at noon. And I call the company and say, I need ice by Tuesday at noon.
And we have a contract. In fact, it's, I don't call them. We have a written contract. Tuesday at noon, delivery of ice. Well, let's say that person forgets to tell their driver. You know, they just, you know, they've been meaning to get around to it, and they didn't get to, they first forgot, and they meant to get around to it, and they were just kind of, really, they either omitted doing it or they were, and I'll use the term negligent, not telling the driver it had to be there by noon, otherwise everything, you know, wilts. So can't there be, although it's not a cause of action in negligence, a breach of my contract because of some omission or some negligent conduct? They didn't tell the driver that. Time is of the essence, and the guy never even told the driver.
I agree entirely, Judge. A contract can give rise to tort-based liability. However, where a contract governs the relationship between the parties and one of the parties fails to live up to that contract, it does not create a cause of action in tort.
A contract can give rise to tort-based liability. That's not really what I meant by my hypothetical. Can't there be a breach of contract based on negligent behavior? But it's a breach of contract. The negligence is I forgot to tell him. I told him too late, and I meant to tell him. And, you know, I didn't tell him time was of the essence. I mean, I'm at fault. You know, their fault. It was just my mistake. It was my negligence. It was my error. But it's still, it's not a cause of action based on negligence. It's a cause of action based on contract because we have a contract.
The contract creates this court has said, the state of things between the parties. The contract forms whatever duties or obligations these two parties had with each other. The fact that the contract is breached by something that may or may not be considered negligent, gross negligent, willfully negligent conduct has no bearing on the fact that the contract was breached.
No, but does it have a bearing on what words we have in this policy?
Yes.
Are you legally obligated to pay for any omission or negligent act?
It does have a bearing on that, Judge. The insuring agreement and the definition require a negligent act, error, or an omission. They don't insure any act or any error. For instance, if T3 hadn't paid its phone company or, a gas supplier or some type of service provider or the ice supplier, if T3 hadn't paid the ice supplier and the ice supplier sued T3, there wouldn't be coverage under this policy. They simply failed to pay an invoice or a bill or a contract.
Yeah.
There's no negligent act, error, or an omission that gives rise to a legal obligation to pay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Hannes talked about the contract that was negotiated, and it was 102 pages long, I believe, or something to that effect, and virtually every contingency was worked out, and there were liquidated damages of more than $11 million that these folks would have to pay if they didn't perform. Are you saying that they didn't buy any insurance that would cover their breach of the contract?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the general liability coverage. The general liability coverage, again, is occurrence-based, and it may exclude liquidated and punitive-type damages. We, of course, take the position that liquidated provisions wouldn't be covered under the Westport policy because they're contractual-based claims with contract remedies.
Isn't the case, at least in the view of the Court of Appeals, the case against Westport was a little stronger in terms of the policy language than against Indiana? If you're out scot-free, isn't there no coverage for this?
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor. Indiana Insurance did not appeal to this court the ruling of the Court of Appeals. It's hard to read tea leaves and predict what would happen on a claim, but to the extent that the general liability insurance coverage is triggered and there's a determination that there are claims that are covered by that policy, yes, Indiana may well owe or have to pay ultimately for claims made by 1325. As to Westport, Judge, though, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals decisions a little more dicey because in the first instance, the Court of Appeals determined the economic loss doctrine shouldn't apply to this claim. Having done that, it then went on to also analyze, in some respects, some of the coverage issues, but really needn't have done that. To the extent that there are tort-based claims in this case, there is at least a trigger of the Westport insurance policy. Now, that doesn't mean at the end of the day that there would be liability for Westport's purposes for every item of damage put up on the chalkboard and recovered by the plaintiffs. The procedural posture of this case is a little bit interesting because we're really up here on the pleadings. A lot of these motions are legal matters that deal with what the parties are entitled to claim and whether there may ultimately be insurance coverage for those claims.
Mr. Tompkins, I know your red light has been on for a while.
I'm sorry,
I know your red light has been on for a while, but I have to ask this question. I'm referring to page 30 of your brief and your assertion regarding the term or the phrase legally obligated to pay as connoting tort, not contract liability. But I've gone back and I've got Green versus Heritage Mutual Insurance Company in front of me now. And as I read that case, and particularly paragraphs 16 and 17 in that decision, I don't see the cases saying that. I see the cases being one of agency, where an agent who does not assume contract liability can't be held under the contract and can't be, what's the term, legal,
get it to pay.
Assuming legal liability. So I don't see it, that clause or that phrase as being as broad as you assert. And in fact, the inference from reading paragraph 17 is that the principal, in fact, could be legally liable under the facts of this case. So it doesn't really separate out contract versus tort. It separates out agent versus principal.
Well, I agree with your rendition of the facts on that, Judge. I think the legally obligated to pay, though, as a bearing in that case, to the extent that the director's and officer's liability policy required legal obligation to pay, the ultimate liability, though, was against the agent's first conduct that was not within that coverage. However, I think under the Wisconsin in Seventh Circuit rulings, legal obligation to pay and negligent act, error, and omission are read as requiring and having a negligence-based component to them.
We haven't said that, right?
This Court has not.
All right.
Nor has this Court held, though, that a professional liability policy would always cover a breach of contract claim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, does your argument depend on the word negligent modifying error or omission?
Yes, it does, Judge. We believe in...
This policy had read error, omission, or negligent act, it would be different?
I think it might, Judge. And as I stand here, I can't think of professional liability policies that have it in that order. I have seen, and there are cases with professional liability coverage that is just straight errors and omissions coverage without the modifier negligent in there at all.
And your position would be that may cover contract, is that it?
Well, some policies, certain types of errors and omissions policies are broader than professional liability errors and omissions policies. For instance, for a title insurance agency or certain insurance-based entities, they can be held liable, and there's insurance coverage for any act or error that they commit in the course of their work, as opposed to a negligent act, error, or omission.
In a medical malpractice or a legal malpractice, would it have the policy say negligent act, error, or omission?
Just 2 days ago, I was looking at a lawyer's policy, Judge, and I'm trying to think if it had negligent act, error, and omission in it. And I can't, as I stand here, I can't recall if it did. I suppose
so. It's obviously contractual relationship.
Well, yes, the attorney's liability can arise out of a contractual relationship.
Okay. Yeah.
However, this Court hasn't applied the economic loss doctrine to attorneys, and I doubt that it would, to the extent that that relationship is a great deal different than a commercial contract between two sophisticated entities like here.
But we've applied it to non-commercial properties, haven't we? I thought we had a homeowner's case, and we applied economic loss to that and didn't limit it to commercial.
That's true. That's a good point, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hurtado,
I recognize you for purposes of making a motion.
I am, Your Honor. I'm just going to turn this down for a moment, and then we'll put it back up for Mr. O'Connor. Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Abrahamson, I'm Kimberly Hurtado of the law firm of Hurtado SC. We are Wisconsin counsel to the plaintiff appellant respondent in this case, 1325 North Van Buren, LLC. I'm here this morning to introduce to the court Attorney Patrick J. O'Connor of the Minneapolis firm of Fagree and Benson. Mr. O'Connor has been admitted pro hac vice in this case, and he will be presenting the oral argument on behalf of the plaintiff 1325.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hannes, Mr. O'Connor, I'm sorry, you're admitted for purposes of arguing this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. It moves on its own. Let me start by responding to a number of the inquiries with regard to insurance coverage. And in preface of that, in terms of why does my client care at all about the economic loss doctrine? I represent the developer in this case. My client only cares about the economic loss doctrine because in this case, it means insurance as far as Westport's concerned. From Westport's standpoint, if there are no tort claims available to my client, there is no insurance coverage available to the insured, and there are no insurance proceeds, meaningful insurance proceeds available to my client.
Counselor, do you agree with that, that if we apply the economic loss doctrine to this case and only contract damages or contract claims may be made, that there is no coverage under Westport's policy?
No, I don't. I think you can easily apply the economic loss doctrine to these factual situation and also conclude that there's insurance coverage for breaches of contract.
This makes it easier to get the insurance money if you don't apply the economic loss doctrine.
Well, it makes it easier when the insurance company takes the position that there is no coverage for anything other than tort claims. I mean, you know, that's the practical reality of the situation that we find ourselves in. And the unusual situation that this case presents is that the very same operative facts that give rise to the breach of contract give rise to the tort claim. You know, it's not a situation where the contract claim really involves different factual situations. Like, for example, if T3 had simply failed to provide the price guarantee, you know, T3 agreed to provide a certain price guarantee. And if T3 just simply said, I'm not going to provide the price guarantee, I'm not going to live up to that particular bargain, that's one thing. Then that's probably not professional error. That's not a, you know, a negligent act, error, and omission. But if T3 failed to provide its construction management services in a way that it was, you know, required to in order to make the construction go smoothly, then that falls within a professional error or omission. And that's what T3 did. And that's what all the allegations in this complaint are. So what you have a situation here is that the same operative facts, if pled in contract, mean no coverage. But if pled in tort, mean coverage. So it's, you know, it's really a kind of a head-scratcher. Why are we limited to coverage only if you're allowed to plead the same failings?
Doesn't that depend, Counselor, on what kind of a policy T3 bought? I mean, insurance coverage isn't determined by the economic loss doctrine. If the contract absolutely was for only tort damages, well, the economic loss doctrine helps the insurer say, I don't have to provide coverage, but it's still a very separate question on whether or not there is coverage. And in every claim where we have the economic loss doctrine raised as a defense, you can always plead a tort claim and a contract claim out of the same facts.
Yeah. Well, let me go back to the first question. I mean, you and I agree that the application of the economic loss doctrine shouldn't dictate coverage.
It can't, because you have a contract that is the insurance contract, and I think our cases are very clear on that, that we look at the four squares of the policy and decide what did people buy.
Right. I mean, that's American Girl. That's the fundamental holding of American Girl. And so the question then becomes, you know, what is it in the policy language, the Westport policy language, that would lead you to conclude that there's only coverage for tort claims, that there's no coverage for breach of contract claims that essentially allege tort-type-like behavior? You know, that's the distinction I'm trying to make. And the only language that you can actually look at all is negligent act, errors, or omission. That's, you know, the legally obligated to pay language has already been dealt with. I mean, I listened to this discourse, but American Rule has already resolved that issue. The same language shows up in general liability policies, legally obligated to pay. And the court in American Rule has already concluded that that insuring clause that contains the same language as the insuring clause in the professional liability policy, legally obligated to pay, isn't restricted to tort liability. So we already know that. We don't have to, you know, don't have to thresh around whether or not legally obligated to pay means tort liability. So then the only thing we're really left with is trying to figure out whether or not the term negligent acts, comma, errors, comma, omissions, means a cause of action grounded in tort. That's what you're left with. And if you use standard insurance principles of construction, you can't get to where Westport wants to go. Because at best, Westport can argue that it has a reasonable interpretation. I frankly don't think it does.
Mr. O'Connor, maybe I have a tendency to focus on words. We're wordsmiths here. Okay. I'm looking at the words in the policy where the Westport policy requires a loss, that a loss arises from a wrongful act, and that wrongful act is defined as actual and negligent act, error, or omission in the performance of professional services. Based on the language of the policy, does it really matter whether we're dealing with a tort or not? Because the policy says, right on its face, that it covers actual or alleged negligent act, error, or omission. And if you have that, regardless of whether you have a tort claim, does it matter?
No,
it doesn't. The policy cover it?
It doesn't matter. You don't need a tort claim to trigger coverage under the policy. All you need is a negligent act, careless act, an error, or an omission. You don't need a claim grounded in tort. And frankly, you look at the definition of claim in that policy. It does not say claim grounded in tort or tort claim. The definition of claim in that policy is very broad.
But is that so? We would have to rewrite the policy if we were going to construe it any differently, right?
Absolutely. You would have to just basically put in that this means, by the way, tort. And there are other problems with the interpretation. And Justice Rorsak mentioned it. You know, what about these exclusions that deal with warranty and guarantees? Why would you have an exclusion for warranty and guarantees and indemnity if the insuring clause only responds to tort liability? I mean, if it only responds to tort liability in the first place, what are exclusions doing in the policy that exclude out certain contract liability? Doesn't make any sense. The problem with Westport's interpretation is that it focuses on three words, misinterprets those three words, and then ignores the rest of the policy language. The fact that claims is broadly defined, the fact that loss is broadly defined, the fact that it has only exclusions in the policy that limit liability for certain types of breach of contract.
Now, Mr. O'Connor, as I've been listening to your argument, you don't care whether it's labeled economic loss or contract. What you care about is only the insurance policy.
Right.
So the heck with all this argument as to whether it's service, product, predominantly this, predominantly that.
Absolutely.
You don't care.
I don't care.
Because you're not really interested in T-13's liability.
Well, I'm only insured.
Only because...
I'm only interested in the insurance.
Right. Exactly. That's my point.
I mean, show me the money. That's why I'm here.
Well, that's why I'm making this point. That's exactly why I'm making the point. Now, and they have maximum coverage of, what is it, $5 million?
That's correct.
I remember that? Okay. So they have maximum, and you don't really care whether it's tort damage or contract damage because it's going to exceed $5 million either way.
Either way, correct.
Are they going to be different, in your opinion? Contract damage and tort damage?
Yes, the contract damages actually are larger in this case than the tort damages because there is a liquidated damage provision
okay.
in the contract.
All right, let's knock out the liquidated.
There's a general rule, no.
Okay, I'm just pressing on the general. So your position with this court, just so we have it absolutely clear, is don't bother court trying to mesh our prior cases and fit them together as to service versus non-service. Let's just look at the policy and make a decision on that.
Well, from my client's perspective, yes. I mean, I would be very happy if you ruled that the economic loss doctrine applies, but there's insurance coverage. You know,
that's fine.
I don't care. I mean, that's,
right.
You know,
it's my the bottom line that you care about.
Yeah, I want.
What does it do to Indiana? Indiana isn't here.
Right.
Court of Appeals decision says it's not economic loss, and then said. Then Indiana is stuck with that for the moment. Of course, if this court overturns it and says it is economic loss, then Indiana probably gets the benefit of that, too, probably. I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Indiana is governed by American Girl. I mean, Indiana's got a general liability policy. American Girl was a general liability
That's
policy.
That's why they're not here?
I can't speak for the counsel, but
it
would have been a waste of time. But also, you know, remember that, well, not remember, but the amount of coverage available under a general liability policy is much different than a professional liability policy. And you have to basically fit within certain pegs, and one of those pegs is property damage. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to avoid all the exclusions in a general liability policy. And they've got a couple of challenging exclusions, which I've acknowledged in the Court of Appeals, and I'll acknowledge here. So the big basket is professional liability.
Got it.
Okay. Yes.
Continue on.
Okay. Well,
could I ask you, does T3 bear 100% of the responsibility for the failure of this project? I mean, what I'm really getting at is somehow there going to be a way to get at some subcontractors, or is that just beside the point?
I don't know how T3 has dealt with its rights down through its subcontracting core, and we call them trade contractors in the construction management system. But, you know, T3 was the manager. It didn't build anything. It was supposed to manage the process. So if things were improperly built, I would assume that, you know, the construction manager can go down through the tiers and look to its subcontractors for that recovery. I mean, I don't know. In this case, I can tell you there aren't a lot of subcontractors in this particular litigation. Whether or not they intend to pursue that in a contribution theory or what, I don't know. But as a general rule, when construction goes bad, you know, the subs are the ones who do the construction, the general. You know, I mean, that's the problem with construction litigation. It's, you know, just lots of parties, and construction litigation gets very expensive. So,
were they paid, the subs? Or don't you know?
I don't know.
I really don't.
Were the subs paid? He doesn't know.
Oh, were the subs paid?
Yeah.
I think 13, if I remember correctly, 1325 paid the subs. You know, even when they dismissed T3 and then continued on with the construction, the subs didn't want to work without any money. You had to pay them. Yeah. You know, so. But let me continue by, even though I made it clear that, you know, I'm really interested in the insurance coverage here, but, you know, since we're talking about economic loss, doctor, let me just give you my 2 cents on it, and then you can use it for whatever it's worth. I think there's a threshold question here that you have to ask yourself. Do we really get on the Linden-Cease continuum at all? I mean, is this case really a case where you're trying to figure out whether or not the T3 1325 contract is somewhere along this continuum? And I would suggest that you don't have to get there. And the reason I suggest that is that unlike every other economic loss doctrine case that Wisconsin has issued, and there's been an awful lot of them, tremendous number of them. In fact, I did a research just, you know, before I came here, put in the term economic loss doctrine in all the states, and the state with the most case law by far is this state, by far. I mean, you outrank New York, and you outrank California, Texas. I mean, you know, Florida comes close. But
what does that say?
You certainly can draw certain conclusions about it, but you know, one of the things that I noticed when I was reading all these economic loss doctrine cases is that there's one thread through them all, and that's there's a defective product, however that term is defined. And you have to ask yourself, in this case, where's the beef? Where is the defective product in this case? If you actually want to take the position that the condominiums are a product, what's defective about the condominiums? There really isn't anything defective about the condominiums. All of my clients' damages, the vast majority of my clients' damages flowed not from the quality of the construction itself, but from the fact that the services being provided by T3 weren't adequate such that the construction was getting done. It just wasn't getting done. It wasn't the fact that you had, you know, leaky windows or bad masonry. Leaky windows.
Didn't you have a broken wall and somebody poking through a floor?
Oh, sure, sure.
That sounds kind of like a defect to me. It certainly had to be repaired. You couldn't use the product as they created it.
What they did is they took out, you know, they were taking out concrete sections and putting in an elevator core, and they swung it around and they hit a wall. True. And they ran over rebar that was in, right. You know, they did a number of those type of things. You add all the damages up, and it's in our appendix, that's $10,000 here, $15,000 here, $20,000 here. My client lost more than $7 million. You know, the damages with regard to property damage are minor, very minor. My client's damages flowed not from a defective product. Even if you want to say that hitting a wall is a defective product, which really, I don't know if it really is. But that's not where my client's damages arose. They arose from the fact that you have professional services that weren't being provided properly and the construction wasn't getting done. Now, it's not in my brief, but I would suggest, because it just was issued last week, I mean, your Court of Appeals are issuing economic loss doctrine cases at a very rapid rate, and a case came out last week called Walker versus Ranger Insurance that I think, frankly, is the same kind of cases we've got here. In Walker, you had a supplier.
That's the case somebody sent to this court.
No, that's true. That's Trinity. Okay. Trinity came out a month ago. Walker came out last week.
Right.
I mean, they're churning out at a very rapid rate. In fact, there's a couple of others coming out, too. But Walker is this case, and I think it's almost on point. Walker is a case where you have a mobile homeowner, and he leased the mobile home to some guy who then entered into a contract with a propane supplier. He then doesn't pay the propane supplier and skips town. Okay? The propane supplier turns off the propane. And what happens? Well, in Wisconsin, in the wintertime, you turn off the propane, the pipes burst, and the mobile home is flooded. So the mobile homeowner then goes and sues the propane supplier, says, you caused all sorts of property damage in my mobile home. The propane supplier says, economic loss doctrine. You know, you can't sue me. You know, we don't have a contract. And there's only economic loss. And the court says the economic loss doctrine doesn't apply in this case. Why? Because there's nothing wrong with the propane. The propane wasn't defective. What was wrong is that you turned it off. Your service that you provided, you didn't provide the propane. That's the same thing here. What happened was that not that the condominiums were defective. It was that the service wasn't provided such that the condominiums were going to get delivered, just like the propane.
What was the damage that there was lateness? You just hire somebody else and they do it. What's the damage?
Well, the damage was the fact that we had pre-sold the units and that we had buyer givebacks. We had loan interest costs because we were more than a year delayed. I mean, it was a tremendous cost to the client in actual damages. The $11 million figure that Justice Prosser mentioned were the liquidated damages. But you had $7 plus, maybe $8 million in actual damages. So, I mean, it was, you know, a tremendous amount of damages that flowed directly from the failure to provide the services, not the defective product.
Would have that been coverable under breach of contract, assuming this the defendant was good for the money?
Oh, sure. Sure. The defendant was good for the money.
Okay.
Yeah, but,
that's what I'm asking.
Okay. Let me take it to the next step. Let's say that you want to get on the slippery slope of this continuum between Linden and Cease and figure out where along that slope this T3 contract falls. You know, I've just suggested that you want to get on that continuum. But if you do, what is it about, you know, the factors, the factor test that leads you to conclude that it falls within the ambit of Cease or the ambit of Linden? And from my perspective, you know, the CM contract, I think, is probably of all the construction agreements that you encounter, and you'll encounter a lot of them. Trinity is the most recent decision that we brought to your decision. You know, that was a design-build contract. But this construction management contract, I think, is the easiest of all the type of construction contracts that you're likely to encounter to fall within the cease or service ambit. And I think this contract is a fairly standard construction management contract in that regard. And the reason for it is that if you look at the predominant factor tests, and one of them is, you know, what was the goals? What was the purpose of this contract? Why did 1325 choose a construction manager rather than a general contractor? Could have just hired a general contractor and gotten the building built. Why did he go with the construction manager? Because he went with the construction manager because he had one overriding concern. I had to have those condominiums built on time.
You could have gotten that same thing with a contract, with a general contractor, and put a completion date in and penalties for not completing on time.
General contractors are not specialists in fast-track construction. This, you know,
it's on the general contractor, Counselor.
Well, it does, but the real essence of the construction management agreement, and it's clear from the way this agreement is set forth and the kind of duties that a construction manager does, is that you provide a lot of pre-construction services. And the purpose of those pre-construction services is to eliminate all the possible problems that are likely to come on during the construction phase. And that's why CMs, that's what the CMs live and die on, is those pre-construction services. Could you have entered into a contract with a general contractor and gotten a general contractor to agree to a very accelerated schedule? Yeah, there are general contractors around that will agree to anything. You know, can they actually get it done? More likely than not, no. I mean, why do CMs exist? Why are they around? Why are there construction managers around?
The CM couldn't get it done either. So it seems like 1325 is in the same pickle as if they'd have hired a general contractor.
Well, and the reason is if you look at, you know, our record in terms of why did this CM fail to get it done? Because it treated the job like a general contractor. Our expert, actually, and it's in the record, our expert came to that conclusion. What was the major failing of T3? It treated the contract like a general contractor. It ignored those construction management services. It just simply went along the process of just building like a general contractor does. What happens when that happens? The construction doesn't get done on an accelerated basis.
Who completed the project?
Another general contractor completed the project.
A general contractor?
Yeah. At that point in time, you hired a general contractor to get done.
That was a Schmitz or something like that?
Yes.
The
reason for that, Your Honor, is by that time you're already in the midst of construction. Pre-construction services don't help you when you're in the midst of construction and the job shut down.
Didn't the people from 1325 know something about Schmitz before?
Well, I think they had negotiations with Schmitz before.
And didn't Schmitz have a very good reputation?
Yes.
Why didn't they choose them?
Well,
wasn't it a matter of about $500,000 or $600,000?
Well, I think price came in. Price was a possibility, sure.
So price was the consideration, not just we're going to pick T3 because they are the people that can get things done, when they didn't really know anything about them.
Well, price was a possibility, but if you take a look at the record, there's an affidavit by. Let me just. I mean, no doubt, Your Honor. I mean, price plays a role in everything. I mean, if you can get construction services done for less money than somebody else, you're likely to go with them. But the affidavits of my client make it pretty clear that one of the things they were concerned about was the actual ability to get it done on time. And so the affidavit of Thomas DeMuth at the trial court record 188, Court of Appeals, our Appendix 2, page 21, says, during negotiations to induce 1325 to enter into the contract with T3, T3 representatives told me that T3 had the experience in providing professional construction management services necessary to successfully manage a project of this complexity and sophistication, that T3 employed competent management personnel with the abilities to address the demands of the schedule and project, that T3's budget and schedule were complete and reliable, and that T3 would retain competent subcontractors to complete the work. I mean, one of the major issues was schedule. And I think the record's pretty complete. Price, yes, price is always a concern. I mean,
if this is a negligent action, does contributory negligence come into play?
Well, I don't know if the state recognizes contributory negligence.
But we do.
Okay. Well, then, on the facts of this case, or theoretically?
Theoretically.
Yes. I don't know on the facts of this case, but theoretically, certainly. Yeah. But.
Might not affect your insurance anyway.
Well, I don't know if contributory negligence. Contributory negligence is a complete bar in this state. Or
it is not a
bar. I don't know enough about your negligence law to be able to.
Well, you know enough about our economic loss law. Why do we have so many cases?
Because you have a rule that currently is ill-defined. I mean, you.
To be blunt.
Yes. I mean, you have a law. You have a rule right now that is basically, it's deviated off the Uniform Commercial Code. You don't use goods anymore. You're using products, and you're trying to define what a product is, and you're wading into the construction services area. You've also got real estate transactions, and anytime you deviate from an established line of demarcation like goods, you're going to get these kind of issues. And your courts and yourself are going to have to grapple with trying to define that line between now and whenever. It's going to be a long time.
Court laws being lost in the sea of contracts?
Well,
to coin the phrase. Yeah. Or to quote a great dissent.
Yeah, that's right. If you would apply it to... that's what Florida concluded. I mean, Florida had a very broad economic loss doctrine and ultimately has moved away from it. I don't, you know, if I were to write the law, I would write it along goods, but I would do that not so much because I'm worried about tort, you know, being lost in a sea of contracts. It's that the problem with an ill-defined line is that the cost of doing business increases significantly, and the cost of litigating disputes increases significantly. I mean, you know, now when parties negotiate these contracts, they have to try to figure out how this is the economic loss doctrine going to apply or not apply. And that becomes much more problematic if indeed they're trying to allocate risks intelligently. And then secondly, when you end up in a dispute, you know, you've got all this wrangling now over whether or not the economic loss doctrine applies and how does it apply and what kind of insurance implications does it have. And it creates a lot of mischief. And so, you know, one of the problems with an ill-defined rule is that it increases the transaction costs of doing business and of litigating disputes. And I think you're seeing it now in all the economic loss doctrine cases coming up in your jurisdiction. So, while I have just a few more minutes, I do want to make one clarification. This contract has been characterized over and over again as a fixed-price contract. This is not a fixed-price contract. Construction managers rarely contract on a fixed-price basis, even if they're a contract CM at risk, with CM constructor. This contract is what's called a guaranteed maximum price contract. What that means is that all the costs of the construction up to the guaranteed maximum price, let's say $6 million, is done essentially on a T&M basis, just like CEASE. Everything costs based upon how much labor and how much services are put into it. It's very different than a fixed price contract or a lump sum contract. So you need to understand that that's one of the major differences between this CM agreement and the Linden agreement. Linden was, I'm going to build your house for $300,000 or however it was. That's not this contract. This contract is, I'm going to charge you for whatever it costs up to this price level. And beyond that, I'm going to take the risk of the construction. But below that, I'm going to charge you based upon the hours expended. And if it costs less to get the project done, you pay the actual cost. You don't pay a lump sum. That's one of the radical differences between this contract and the Linden contract. I think, Your Honor, that I've probably covered as much as I need to cover. There's no reason for me to stand up here and just
pry. Good idea, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to just wait until rebuttal because the marshal has to change the disc upon which you're being recorded. So just sit down. Think big thoughts. Thank you.
I'd like to conclude with sort of the fundamental question and sort of picking up on where Mr. O'Connor left off, the fundamental question of this idea of deviating from products versus services, UCC-based transactions versus non-UCC-based transactions, and this sort of perhaps fear that by moving beyond the products realm, moving the economic loss doctrine beyond the realm of defective products, we're somehow opening up the door to difficulties in articulating and applying a workable economic loss doctrine. I think the court needs to take a critical look at the decision in CIS. The decision in CIS is driven by the nature of the contract parties had. CIS was a simple oral service agreement to wire a ventilation system for a chicken coop. The court's reasoning for refusing to apply the economic loss doctrine in CIS was driven by, I think it's fair to say, an overgeneralization about the nature of service contracts, that they tend to be informal, that they tend not to involve bargain for remedies. Many of them are oral. They're not written. If I'm reading this CIS decision correctly, I think the concerns that drive the decision are those parties in that case did not engage in any of the negotiating, bargaining for remedies that presumptively underlies the application of the economic loss doctrine.
If I could, Mr. Hannes, maybe I misunderstood it, but I think that Mr. O'Connor's point was a little bit different. I think what he is referring to is how far the state has gone since Sunny Slope and the roots of the economic loss doctrine and what it meant at one point and where we are now. And I think his point, and I think this is the question, is have we strayed too far afield to the point where we've actually created the type of litigation that we would hopefully try to limit?
Absolutely not. And I think it is essential to move the economic loss doctrine beyond the realm of products and to eliminate the distinction merely on how we characterize the subject matter of the contract. Go ahead, Mrs. Brown.
No, please.
In a case like this, where the parties have exhaustively spelled out their rights and obligations, they've set forth an extremely broad, comprehensive, tailor-made remedial scheme. And the only damages at issue are essentially for economic loss, for loss of the benefit of the bargain, classic breach of contract type damages. This is a case that cries out for the application of the economic loss doctrine. There is no rational justification to give one of these two parties a tort-based remedy.
Why do we have to deal with economic loss doctrine? Isn't this an insurance contract case right now?
We're looking at the Supreme Court level, we're looking at the issues in isolation. We're focused on the tort claims and the application of the economic loss doctrine. When you're down at the trial court level, you're defending all of the claims, and not just the tort claims, the breach of contract claims. And this defense was raised very early on at the trial court level in an effort to eliminate one of the causes of action and to leave the plaintiff with one single cause of action. And so it's not a merely academic point from a defensive standpoint. It's attacking all of the claims.
The issue before us is, maybe I'm wrong, isn't it? And your opposing counsel rather irreverently said something about, well, you know, the reason I'm here is for money. You know, we all laugh because irreverent as it is, it's true, you know. But isn't this case determined on what's in the insurance policy? I mean, isn't that what it, this case is governed by?
Well, again,
isn't this a coverage case?
Maybe I'm wrong.
Is this a coverage case?
As a practical matter, I agree with you. And frankly, I don't understand why I'm here anymore, because the plaintiffs could proceed in a direct action against Westport Insurance Company, and it mystifies me as to why my client remains a party to this case, particularly when they're judgment-proof.
Counselor, though, didn't the Court of Appeals decide the economic loss doctrine does not apply to this transaction, and it is in a published opinion? So aren't you here to straighten out that issue? I thought that's what you were arguing from your
Absolutely. Race. And we remain a party to this case, and as long as we remain a party to this case, we are here and we are defending those tort claims on the basis of the economic loss doctrine. But I guess what I'm saying, what I'm suggesting in response to Justice Abrahamson, is that my client is, if the plaintiffs wished, they could let T3 out of this case.
Right.
And they could proceed in their direct action against Westport on the insurance matter of insurance coverage only. That was never done, and so we remain in the case, and we're here defending the merits of the claims that have been asserted against T3, and we'll continue to do that as long as we remain a party.
Mr. Hannes, if I could cheat, there's one problem I have with your argument, and I wasn't going to raise this until you raised it, but when you talk about expanding the economic loss doctrine to the service area and rethinking cease, which is what you've argued here today, the problem that I have with that argument is that both nationally and in this state, courts have been criticized for legislating from the bench, creating new judicial policies, running amok with the law. And yet, the economic loss doctrine has only been in existence since 1978 in this state, and it is the most expansive doctrine that this court has ever created, and we keep expanding it. At some point, should we not pause and just look at what we're doing and what we're doing to the litigation field? We've heard from opposing counsel, all of the cases in the country, they all fall on Wisconsin. Wisconsin is the home of the economic loss doctrine as far as litigation is concerned. And are we really creating a haven for attorneys in making money at the expense of their clients, or should we really sit down and narrow out the rules and clearly define them so that everybody knows what they're dealing with when they enter into these contracts?
That is an excellent question, and I agree that that is probably what drives the decision in Cease. It is an effort to create a bright line test. But the problem that I have with Cease is that it works in injustice in cases like this, where the parties do in fact have a contract that spells out all of their rights and remedies. And when they went to painstaking lengths to spell out all of their rights and remedies, and all of the damages claimed by the plaintiff are compensable pursuant to the terms of the contract. And the question is, why do you take that contract? And there is a constitutional right to freedom of contract recognized in this state under the state constitution as well as the U.S. Constitution. It is a constitutionally guaranteed right of liberty and property. And the question becomes, why do you take away the bargained-for agreement between these parties, a $6 million contract, when there's no dispute that all the damages are compensable pursuant to the terms of the agreement, and give one of these parties a tort-based remedy? That works an injustice for one of the parties to the contract. That bargain is being taken away from them, and the contract is being tossed in the garbage in favor of a tort-based remedy. That seems to me to be fundamentally unfair. And it does not matter whether we characterize the contract as one for services or products. The economic loss doctrine is a damages-based doctrine. It speaks to the nature of the damages that are being alleged, not the cause of those damages, whether it's a product, a service, a piece of real estate, intellectual property. It's the nature of the harm that's being alleged that the plaintiff is attempting to recover, not the cause of the harm. And that's where I think we run afoul when we engage in this product versus service distinction. I think in a case like this, that distinction is essentially arbitrary. And perhaps in the Cease case, it has some meaning because that is a case where the parties did not have bargained for remedies. It was a simple oral contract. And the UCC did not come in to fill the void left by the parties in their failure to bargain for rights and remedies. And so the distinction in the Cease case does have meaning under those circumstances. But what we're talking about, a sophisticated, comprehensive commercial agreement that lays it all out and exhaustively addresses the rights and remedies of the parties, and it's clear that the only damages alleged are for breach of contract, we should leave those parties to their contract regardless of how we characterize the subject matter of the contract. And I think one of the questions that the Court has to wrestle with is, what do we do with other types of service providers? What do we do with lawyers? What do we do with doctors? What do we do with accountants?
Well, we may leave that for another case, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Okay, Rich.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thanks to this Court for its time. It's always a bad day for an insurance counsel when the main focus of a dispute is working on insurance coverage and going backwards. Be that as it may, Judge, Your Honors, I believe there are a few points in 1325's argument that bear further analysis. Should I wait?
Yes.
No.
Just go ahead.
You're all right. I'll try to limit my comments to a handful of five. First, to this Court, the American Girl opinion is kind of hovering over this case in some ways, and it shouldn't be. In the American Girl case, the Court, at least at this level, wasn't even dealing with the economic loss doctrine claims. Those tort-based claims were still a part of that lawsuit, and the courts below had ruled on the application of the economic loss doctrine. Here, obviously, the lower court has. One way or the other, that issue is not more focused in this case. Also in American Girl, the coverage there that was analyzed was occurrence-based liability coverage. That is, that was a general liability insurance policy providing coverage for an accident, which is defined broadly to include anything unforeseen. That's not the case with this coverage. The Westport coverage isn't occurrence-based coverage. It's not general liability coverage, and it includes within it the concept of negligent or tort-based remedies. Part of the way this argument is formed this morning is really an effort, and I think counsel's kind of admitted that, to bootstrap coverage. We need a way to find coverage for these claims. And I submit to you that you should focus more on the nature of the claims. What are the claims that are being sought, as opposed to whether or not there should be a remedy against an insurance policy?
Isn't it a dual issue? You have to label what the claim is. Think about the claim in a legal matter, but then see where it is in the policy. I mean, just labeling it contract or economic loss applies or doesn't apply doesn't answer you. The question of whether your client is liable. To look at the policy.
Well, the question of whether my client is obligated to pay for the damages, I think, does turn, in essence, on the nature of the claims. As I tried to point out earlier, not any claim is covered under an insurance policy.
No, but your policy doesn't say we don't cover economic loss claims.
No, it certainly doesn't say that.
So.
I think that's clear.
Okay.
It does, though, and I think it bears focus by this Court to look at the language that is in the policy. We've gone over it a number of times. The claim has to arise out of or by reason of a wrongful act. A wrongful act is a negligent act, error, and omission. And there has to be a legal obligation to pay.
Counselor, I have a question that came up that I want to ask you about that occurred to me during opposing counsel's argument when he said that most of their damages were not for conduct, but really for failing to perform. So we're not looking at a wrongful act, we're looking at a lack of an act. How does that fit within your policy? Have you thought about looking at it that way? I hadn't until he brought it up in argument.
but.
I owe counsel a thank you then for bringing that up, Judge. Yes, I think it does bear on coverage issues because there wasn't a delivery of a product that hurt somebody. There wasn't delivery of a product or a building that fell on somebody. There just wasn't delivery. The commercial agreement between these parties never came to fruition.
Isn't that an omission?
It may arise out of failures. Yes, in a way it is, because the contract claim here, all it lists as basis for its claims are failure to X, failure to do this.
But don't your policy cover omissions?
Our policy covers negligent acts, errors, and omissions. But I think more fundamentally, Your Honor, is that if the nature of the claim is contract-based, the remedy for the party is to put that person in the same position they would have been in. Unlike a negligence claim, you can never put that party back in their position they should have been in. You award them damages for their loss.
Here, maybe I'm missing something, and once again, I'm focusing on the language of your policy. Your policy doesn't talk in terms of natures of claims or whether or not different doctrines apply. Your policy covers wrongful acts, which is defined as negligent acts, errors, or omissions. Now, regardless of whether you apply negligence, nobody's talked about this, negligence to all three or just to the acts, if you are dealing with a negligent omission or an omission, depending upon whether we link negligent to omission, doesn't your policy cover that? Is that not a wrongful act under the policy?
No, I would submit it doesn't, Judge. And the reason,
why?
The reason for that is that, and even Cease helps me in this respect. Even in Cease, this Court held that a contract assumes there's bargaining between the parties. A contract between two sophisticated parties assumes that they've negotiated and that they've bargained. When that's breached, you restore the non-breaching party to the position it would have been in, regardless of negligence.
Maybe I'm missing something, but you have a separate contract. You have a contract with, is it, T3.
Right.
Your contract is that you're going to provide insurance for wrongful acts, errors, or omissions. Negligent acts, errors, or omissions. That is your contract. So why doesn't your contract control here? Why doesn't your policy control? And why aren't we talking about that?
Well, I think we are, and I think they do. Our policy definitely controls an obligation, whether or not there's an obligation for us to pay for a liability incurred by T3. However, as in any claim, as in any type of tort analysis, you have to look at the nature of the claim that's being made against the insured. For instance, it doesn't matter if they plead negligent misrep or intentional misrep or strict liability, that the label on the theory doesn't apply so much as the nature of that claim. What is the core of that claim? And here the core of that claim is defeated economic expectations in a contract. Unlike a claim, for instance, arising out of a strict tort-based liability, a car injuring somebody or another professional not governed by the economic loss doctrine, incurring liability for an negligent act, error, or omission.
Thank you.
Judge, I believe, just in closing, that in a way, two contracts would be rewritten in this case. The insurance policy that Westport issued would essentially be rewritten into a performance bond. It would basically be this Court saying, look, if there's a failure of performance, liability insurance will cover that, when something like a performance bond would easily have done that as well. We make that argument in our briefs as well. There's no performance bond coverage obtained by anybody in this case, and it could have been, to cover this very possibility. The fact that there's insurance coverage out there doesn't always lead to the fact that it applies to a claim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomkiewicz, Mr. Hannes, Mr. O'Connor, for your discussions today of economic loss doctrine, a doctrine that the courts are very familiar with, and maybe the Court of Appeals even more so. And we appreciate you doing that. Mr. O'Connor, you are not licensed to practice law in Wisconsin after this hour is over. You're aware of that, and you're not distressed, I gather. Good. Well, thank you for coming. And that concludes 04 AP 352, 1325 North Van Buren versus T3 Group. We're in recess till 1:30.